First case this morning is United States v. Robinson. Is the appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Cody Cheek, and along with my co-counsel, Major Julie L. Borchers, we represent the appellant in this case, Specialist Torrence Robinson. There are three issues before the court today, and I'd like to address them slightly out of order from the briefs. I'm going to start with the 412 ruling, move to legal sufficiency, and then conclude with the instructional error. First, the military judge abused his discretion by excluding constitutionally required evidence under MRE 412B1C. Specifically, the military judge excluded evidence that Specialist Robinson and VM flirted and talked about having sex with each other on numerous occasions. This evidence was necessary for a fair trial, as it would allow Specialist Robinson to present evidence necessary to present his defense and confront his accuser. Most importantly, the evidence was vital toward Specialist Robinson's defense. Absent the necessary contextual information excluded by the military judge, any ignorance or mistake of fact defense might seem unreasonable, beginning with the idea that VM's conduct in her barracks room should have immediately conveyed to Specialist Robinson her apparent level of intoxication. However, when viewed in the context of their prior flirting and prior conversations about having sex with each other, such beliefs from Specialist Robinson become far more reasonable, which was the exact point of the defense counsel, who explained to the military judge the evidence was essential, imperative to our defense. And
Captain Cheek, didn't the military judge let some of this evidence come in, like on the night of the incident?
Yes, Your Honor. He did say that evidence of that type of interactions that occurred the night of the incident would be admissible. But I have three points to that, Your Honor.
Regarding the other evidence, you mean?
Well, I guess regarding the import and effect of his ruling, Your Honor.
Okay.
The first is that the testimony that came out at trial was that they only saw each other for 5 minutes that night at the party. So to the extent that there was any interactions between the two that would have been admissible under his ruling, it was only 5 minutes. It was very brief. It was very short. Second, Your Honor, the one part that he did say was admissible turned out to, as it came out at trial, so he subsequently flipped his ruling and said it was inadmissible based on what the witness testified at trial. The judge had made a finding, or he believed that it happened the night of the party, the way the evidence came out at trial. It didn't. So that evidence subsequently became excluded. But lastly, and I think most fundamentally, Your Honor, relationship, past experiences inform present perceptions. And the experiences and the relationship between Specialist Robinson and VM did not start the night of that party. It started months prior, and relationships exist on a spectrum. And what happens and what occurs between two individuals will shape and mold and develop how they see the relationship and how they perceive their interactions. So I guess, Your Honor, even though the judge did say anything from that night could come in, you know, that was essentially putting a soda straw over the nature and type of the relationship between the two.
Is flirtation sexual behavior?
Full candor to the court, we believe it is, Your Honor, and we're not challenging it, or we have not challenged it on those grounds.
Yep.
Getting back to what the defense counsel explained to the judge at the motions hearing, the last thing, in addition to saying it's essential, imperative, the defense counsel explained it was the crux of the defense theory. The defense counsel also explained the panel members should not view the evidence, quote, in a vacuum, and they instead needed to view the incident, quote, through Specialist Robinson's eyes. Overall, based on the military judge's ruling, and exactly as the defense counsel feared, the panel was left with a misleading, inaccurate, and incomplete perspective of the previous interactions and overall relationship of the two.
Let me ask you this. Excuse me, Judge Olson. What if, now you've said that the evidence that the military judge initially was going to allow in only pertain to a five-minute period during the night of the incident. Now, what if that had not occurred, and all you were left with was just these other incidents of alleged flirtation from a previous time? Would you be making the same argument?
Your Honor, I do want to provide one clarification. Right. It wasn't just that their interaction. He said anything that can kind of be affixed to that night. Mm-hmm. So I certainly didn't want to misconstrue the effect of this.
No, I understand. So, but you understand my question now?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'd like to answer it by saying that it wasn't just the flirting. It was also the conversations about having sex, the numerous conversations to that extent. And Your Honor, I think that's important in this case.
So you would be making the same argument, regardless of what little contact they had had during the night of the incident, prior to the actual incident.
I think for the prejudice analysis, it would be different, and it would be harder for us if they had spent the entire evening together. Maybe it's a different, maybe we're having a different conversation, but I guess our perspective and our argument would be that the limited interactions that night, what the panel was left with was that they knew they were merely in the same company, they'd had some professional interactions, and they saw each other for 5 minutes that night at the party. So the way it came out at trial, again, that very limited perspective, and the panel asked for more context. There was a question from a panel member in which he asked a bifurcated question. One second part of the question was clearly inadmissible, but the other part of the question the panel member asked was, from what you know about VM, did she ever display interest towards Specialist Robinson? And I think that it, again, goes back to our point over, you know, relationships exist on a spectrum, but I think to answer your question in a very long, roundabout way, I believe we would be making the same argument.
So, Captain Cheek, let's turn our attention, if you would please, to issue of harmlessness. Let's assume for a moment that this court were to agree with your position that you've just outlined. Why wouldn't it be harmless in this context where even the accused said he questioned whether the victim was capable of consenting? And there was a lot of testimony from other people present at the party who indicated that the victim was very intoxicated. And the mere fact that there was flirting, let's even say in a different scenario, the two individuals had had sexual relations before. If she was incapable of consenting, that wouldn't matter. So why is this not a problem for your client in terms of the harmlessness issue?
Your Honor, three responses. And I think a portion of one response will be addressed in legal sufficiency. But certainly to squarely jump right into it, the most problematic portion and the reason that I think that this is not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is when Specialist Robinson was not able to fully answer the most important, pertinent, and critical question in this case. And that was when he was asked, why did you think she consented to having sex with you? He says, we've spoken about it before. Objection sustained. Panel members, you will disregard anything that happened prior to that night. So I think that in the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt context, that in and of itself, precluding him from being able to answer the threshold critical question in the case, is a strong indicator of prejudice, especially in the constitutional realm or constitutional error. But second, Your Honor, I want to go back to what I was referencing a bit earlier. The panel asked about this. This was something the panel wanted to know about. And with this additional information, the panel could have thought, you know, that his position in his testimony, his story, was far more reasonable. And that his story, the real danger here, I think, Your Honor, is that they could have said, even assuming everything he said is true, even assuming all of it, we'll just assume it all happened, he's still guilty. Based off of how limited they knew each other, and again, they'd asked for more context, I think that's a real strong danger here in this case.
But in your analysis, aren't you intertwining your argument for why it should come in with this argument of harmlessness? In terms of harmlessness, don't we need to look at the quality and quantity of the evidence that came in?
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to, I guess, slide right into, this was not a strong case. And, in fact, is one of the specified issue in this case is whether the evidence was even legally sufficient to begin with. And one of the things you said, Your Honor, is, you know, the testimony of other people at the party. Now, there were five witnesses, apart from Specialist Robinson and VM, who talked about what happened at the party. And there's two things I want to point out about their collective testimony of all five of them. And first, that's every single one of them who saw her leave the party. They testified they saw her run down the stairs without stumbling or falling, start her car, and drive away. Essentially, their testimony was a clear chasm from VM's testimony, as she believed she was having trouble or perceived that she was struggling. But the second point, Your Honor... But
didn't appellant testify that he, or say to CID, that he saw her hit a stop sign, I believe it was, on her departure in her vehicle?
I think what he said was that when she left in a haste or in a hurry, he saw her leave angrily, or he perceived it to be anger. But, yes, he did see her almost hit a stop sign. But in the context of what had just happened, the argument, running down the stairs, getting in the car, driving away quickly, and that's, you know, again, supported by numerous other witnesses who all saw the same thing. Even in the light most favorable to the government under the standard for this assignment of error, I think that it's a reasonable person or a rational fact finder would see that it was as much of being in a hurry as it was being intoxicated in the context of the kind of not peeling out but driving. But I think the more baseline thing, Your Honor, is that all five of those witnesses, they provided clarifying or contextual testimony over her apparent level of intoxication. So Mr. Rodriguez, the host of the party, he said he was with her most of the night, but he didn't think she was intoxicated. I think that's, he agreed. You were with her most of the night? He said, yes, I was, but I didn't think she was intoxicated. I thought she was more angry than intoxicated. My brother was kind of being a drunken idiot. So that's Mr. Rodriguez. With her most of the night, didn't think she was intoxicated. Then you had Specialist Natal, who talked about, you know, her motor skills. Trial counsel says, did she have any issues with her motor skills? No. He also said that she was talking and interacting with others and in control of her body. So he did say, and the government, you know, points out in their brief that he did say that he thought she was tipsy or sloppy. But I think that that is drastically overridden by the no motor skill issue, talking, interacting with others, control of her body. The third witness, Specialist Adams, said the same thing.
As you go on, I don't want your time to expire without giving you an opportunity to address the issue of the mens rea requirement.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. To briefly conclude over the second issue, in sum, even viewing the evidence light most favorable, the testimony of the people at the party, the testimony in the barracks room, one person says these things happened, the other person says they could have, and then the expert witness testimony from Major Smith, putting all that together, we believe it's legally insufficient. Lastly, moving to the instructional error, the military judge committed plain error when he failed to instruct the panel on the mens rea required for the specification of Charge 1, which involved an Article 92 violation of 600-20.
So why doesn't the fact that there is the word wrongful in that article save this for the government?
I think for the same reason it didn't in Haverty. Your Honor, it was a single undefined term that was not contained in the regulation itself. And in fact, this case is strikingly similar to Haverty, and the same analysis, rationale, and result should apply in this case.
Why isn't it strikingly similar to Caldwell?
Your Honor, I think it's readily distinguishable for the same three reasons it was distinguishable in Haverty. And that's this court pointed out that in Caldwell, there is no scenario in which Article 93 can be said to criminalize innocent conduct. Haverty used the drinking game hypothetical, and really I think...
So what is your hypothetical where this conduct, or conduct that would on its face of the statute be proscribed, in fact be innocent conduct?
Your Honor, I don't even think we need a hypothetical. Respectfully, I don't even think we need a hypothetical. I think this case, this is that case in and of itself.
But reading your brief, you seem to be, and I realize this is a nuanced point, but you seem to be conflating a factual sufficiency argument with this issue of whether this conduct could have in fact been innocent. In other words, You seem in your brief to be saying the conduct which the appellant engaged in here should not have been considered prescribed conduct under the article. But you really seem to be saying that under the five bullet points about what is wrongful fraternization, that this shouldn't fit. That seems to me to be two different, and I recognize, nuanced issues there.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the point was trying to demonstrate that there is a set of facts.
So what would those facts be, though?
I think it is this case. And I don't mean to, again, run afoul of impeaching the verdict, but this is someone where a newly promoted E5 is invited, or recently promoted, again, I think it had been a few months, a recently promoted E5 is invited to a party by someone he has a pre-existing relationship with, accepts the invitation, arrives, sees that he does not have a supervisory relationship over.
Okay, but you seem to be getting at the point that your conclusion is that it didn't fit any of these five bullet points, didn't compromise the chain of command, didn't cause actual or perceived partiality, and so forth. But that's an objective determination by the fact finder. So if, in fact, they fit within those five bullet points, the conduct fit within those five bullet points, then how are you saying it is conduct that is proscribed by the regulation or the provision, the article, but, in fact, is innocent conduct?
Chief Judge Stuckey, I see that out of time.
Please answer the question.
Your Honor, I think, as you said, it is slightly nuanced, and I can certainly see how my brief, as soon as you say it, you realize it. I'd like to address that first in rebuttal and be a little bit contemplative over my response.
You may do so.
Chief Judge, may I ask a question or two about 412? With respect to 412, if we agree with you that the evidence, and I'm not asking you to discuss any sealed material here, if we agree with you that the evidence is relevant in the broad sense of relevance or the narrow sense, some tendency to prove, do you prevail at that point, or do we have to also determine whether the judge erred with respect to any balancing of the probative value of that evidence versus the privacy of the individual?
Your Honor, if possible, I'd like to address that second in rebuttal right after Judge Olson's question.
Okay. And my next question related to that, which you can also address in rebuttal, is in doing so, do we look to the degree of specificity of any testimony or other evidence presented in the 412 hearing that would draw a relationship between prior conduct or conversations and what happened that night?
Your Honor, I'll dovetail that after consulting with my co-counsel.
Glad to hear from you then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Cassandra Esposo, and along with Major Cormick Smith, I represent the government. This court should affirm the findings and sentence for three reasons. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when defense counsel failed to articulate a theory of relevancy or necessity under MRE 412b1 charge.
Counsel, could you just pull the microphone closer?
Yes, please.
Second, based on Specialist VM and appellant's statements, a reasonable fact finder could have found the appellant knew or should have known Specialist VM was incapable of consenting. And third, the military judge properly instructed the panel that general intent was the appropriate mens rea for a fraternization offense under Army Regulation 600-20. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion because defense counsel failed to detail a theory of relevance and constitutional necessity. Here, the relevance is any tendency to make any fact more or less probable. But in simply putting on evidence of prior flirting hugging, or potential discussions, defense counsel failed to put on evidence linking it to the actual...
Counsel, what do you mean by the phrase potential discussions? And again, I'm not asking you to reveal what's in the sealed material, but are we talking about actual discussions or potential discussions?
Appellant stated that there were discussions regarding that Special CM and Appellant had discussions regarding having sex.
Isn't that extremely probative? I mean, you know, the problem with relevance often is not that something's not relevant, but that it's way too relevant, and it's thought to have too much effect on the minds of the fact finders. Whether or not this goes in, it's hardly not relevant, isn't it?
In this context, it could be, sir, but flirting by itself, when the actual issue is whether...
Well, I mean, there are questions of temporality.
Yes, sir.
And that kind of thing. When did they flirt?
Yes,
and what verbal exchanges did they have? And that kind of thing. But it seems to me that the general, that if this proffered evidence is being described accurately, that it's very hard to say that it's not probative and it's not relevant.
Understood, sir. But given, again, since this was charged by intoxication and defense counsel failed to link how prior conversations over the past 4 months without that specificity or context could lead him to believe that she was capable of consenting. So the military judge's finding was actually that they couldn't link these acts of flirting or conversations to the night in question. Again, that doesn't mean that consent is not relevant to intoxication specifications. That's is shown in his rationale in letting specialists end prior comments about how they were flirting that evening to attack that element of why he appellant believes Specialist VM was capable of consenting.
So if, and again, not asking you to reveal sealed information, they had discussions repeatedly about engaging in specific sexual acts. Let's just say hypothetically, not this particular case, but individuals had discussions repeatedly about engaging in specific sexual acts and hoping that they would be together on an evening after a party to do that. Why would that not be relevant and probative and admissible? Not asking you to suggest that that's in this case, but I'm trying to probe the issue that you're talking about where you say that the charge of intoxication, the charge bringing intoxication is somehow preclusive here of considering that information. Why wouldn't that information always be relative and probative, subject to a balancing test, on the question of whether, at minimum, the question of whether there's a mistake of fact as to intoxication, and then the underlying issue of consent related to it?
The government stance is not absolute. In that case, certainly, it would be up to the abuse of discretion of the military judge to determine whether or not defense counsel has properly made it relevant. But in this case, all that was presented regarding the conversations was just a one line saying that he had conversations with her in the past. Had there been something more, like the hypothetical posed by Your Honor, certainly we would move on to the next step of materiality and balancing.
Then under the government's view, this court will have to examine the sealed material to ascertain whether there was a statement that was so vague that it was not probative, or whether there are statements that were made that were sufficiently specific as to be probative in this case.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. But again, in this context, Your Honor, that link is in fact missing. Flirting by itself, conversations by itself, is not properly linked to why defense would or why appellant would believe that she was capable of consenting.
But to test that assertion, don't we have to look at the sealed material?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
However, even if the military judge did err, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It's because, again, mistake of fact as to consent is still not the substantial issue here. It is the mistake of fact as to intoxication.
Mistake of fact as to what?
As to her capability to consent.
Yeah, you said that, and then you said something else that I didn't get.
It's the substantial issue in question is still the intoxication.
Oh, intoxication. Okay.
Yes, sir. Appellant was still able to discuss at least a certain level of familiarity during that evening. He knew where she lived. When he followed her several hours later, she called.
No. If he could have reasonably mistaken the fact that, you know, mistaken consent, then what's intoxication got to do with it? Intoxication per se isn't, you know, she was intoxicated. But if the premise is true, then I don't see what intoxication's got to do with it. The mere fact of intoxication, without more. If you allow that, based on, you know, and I'm not asking the government to concede this or anything, but if you posit that he could have made a reasonable mistake as to her consent, based on prior conversations or flirting or what have you, then what's intoxication got to do with it? Because I think we're already past intoxication, aren't we?
If you reasonably believe she consented, well, Your Honor, that's... An accused cannot simultaneously believe that the victim was incapable of consenting and also believe that she was legally consenting. So if he knew that she was intoxicated but that she was saying yes, that is not legal consent.
Oh?
So,
cite me a case that holds that.
Sir, it is not in government's brief. There is an ACCA case, USVT, that discusses the difference between legal consent and how it is.
So are we talking about basically babbling consent as opposed to rational consent? I don't get what you're talking about.
Right, sir. So if appellant, as he states during his testimony on the merit, that she was saying yes and actively involved, that mistake of fact as to consent is still not a defense under 916 if he believes that she is intoxicated. So if she's still actively involved in, or not actively, but if
now, okay, that's what I thought you were saying.
Yes.
You're saying if he believes she's intoxicated, that's an absolute bar to legal consent.
Or if it's under the definition of USVP, that she is the mental ability to make or communicate a decision.
Well, no, that's something else. That's something else. I think what you're saying the government's position is that if he believes she's intoxicated, full stop, she's incapable of consent.
That if she's
how intoxicated and with what? I think this raises all kinds of problems that I'm not sure. Well, go ahead.
Has the defense conceded that the accused believed in this case that the victim was intoxicated to the point of not being able to consent?
They have not conceded that, Your Honor, but there is evidence on the record that he knew or should have been incapable of consenting.
That's your contention at this point. But what you're trying to do is, I think, is to take that contention and attribute it to the mental state of the accused or the appellant in this case, such that the appellant can't raise the issue of consent whatsoever. If the court were to determine that the evidence doesn't establish intoxication to the point of not being able to consent,
is the government precluded from prevailing on the question of whether consent was or not established in this case?
So if I understand your question, Your Honor, if looking at the other way, if the military judge erred on the first issue, could we not use that for the legal sufficiency?
Yeah, that's a question on my part, not an assertion.
In this case, Your Honor, still no, because the, at least in this context, the defense counsel did not, they still missed that linking element of the flirtation and the conversations to the actual incident in question. Again, had they discussed how the consent or why he believed that she was consenting or how that affects intoxication during the 412 hearing itself, then arguably, yes, that would affect the second assignment. But in this case, the evidence was strong, not just the statements of Specialist VM self-reporting her intoxication, but also based on appellant's own statements. She told CID that he knew she was too drunk to consent. He said that she was a 7 out of 10 on a drunk scale. He did, in fact, watch her swerve and almost hit a stop sign when she was leaving the party. And when he arrived to her barracks room, 2 hours later, first he noticed the trash can and water by her bed, and then he asked her, "Do you know who I am?" After knowing her for several months beforehand, his first question is, "Do you know who I am?" Indicating that there is some, indicating that he knew or should have known that she was too intoxicated when he entered that room. Turning to the final issue, this court should affirm the specification of charge one because general intent is sufficient to separate.
I thought you were going to talk about HBRD, and that some I think got lost.
Oh yes, sir. My apologies. So turning
why is it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, even if the judge erred?
Yes, sir. So in addition to the strength of the actual evidence regarding the intoxication and knew that or should have known that she was unable to consent, they also were able to present evidence of the level of familiarity and flirting that evening, specifically that she did call him by his first name despite the fact that she had always known him as a sergeant, but she did call him by Tori, as well as him, again, knowing where she lived, knowing what floor she was on, knowing how to get through the back entrance. So there is already a relationship established where he is familiar with her, she is familiar with him, and so it wasn't entirely based on government counsel's questions regarding how do you know him in the workplace.
Well, which way does that cut? Doesn't that shore up the flirtation and talking and everything else? They had a continuing relationship, and they talked about having sex. Which way does that cut?
Are you in the government side, Your Honor? Because it at least gives
fair enough
that there's at least a relationship outside of work, that they did know each other and that they were familiar with each other. Okay. So to the extent that defense counsel was able to put on that it was more than just a work relationship, they were able to do. And again, also that they were
okay. Now can we have mens rea?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Now, in regard to the mens rea issue, the military judge gave both a brief and a truncated instruction to the panel. All the military judge really said was, you have to find beyond a reasonable doubt, one, there's lawful general regulation in effect, two, accused had a duty to obey the regulation, and three, that the accused violated this lawful general regulation by wrongfully fraternizing the junior enlisted soldiers, and then said, panel members, go read the rest of the regulation. That's what I mean by truncated. So we here as lawyers can look at this in terms of threading a needle, saying that wrongfulness gets us to subjective intent, that gets us to this issue of a general intent and knowledge of the actus reus and on and on and on, as we lawyers like to do. But as panel members, without any of that type of instruction, and only this going in front of them, why couldn't the panel members, in fact, have been applying a strict liability standard on the accused, simply saying, hey, he was with junior enlisted, and it fits these five bullet points, therefore it was wrongful, and therefore he's guilty.
So, in addition to the wrongful instruction, there's also a subsection in 414 that discusses that all members are responsible for maintaining professional relationships and being cognizant of that. It does put the onus on the appellant or the more senior ranking person to terminate those relationships. So it does a little bit more than just strict liability. It points to thinking about the relationship, who's responsible for terminating it, and although it's not as expressed as...
How is that relevant? Now that's getting into this issue of it doesn't have to be senior subordinate, it can be subordinate senior, but why is that relevant to the issue of the mens rea requirement, informing the panel members this is how your thought process must work in terms of you making a determination about the mindset of the accused?
Yes, sir. Admittedly, there is no express language stating that they should there's no direct language in 414 that specifically states they should consider that thought process. However,
but furthermore, there's nothing in the instructions. So why isn't that deadly to the government's case?
Yes, sir. It's the combination between the wrongful instruction that they flagging the panel that they should be considering his mental state in combination.
But it's only the invocation of the word wrongful. It's not the military judge explaining what wrongful means and the context in which to apply it. That's why the concern I'm expressing to you, and I'd like to hear the government's view, is why could this not be perceived as the potentiality for the panel members to simply say, was with enlisted soldiers, junior enlisted, doesn't matter that he knew they were junior enlisted, and it's these five bullet points, therefore it was wrongful. There is then no subjective intent or knowledge of the actus reus that is required for the panel members to determine the guilt or innocence of the accused.
But in the case of fraternization, Your Honor, creating an unduly familiar relationship So, at least in this circumstance, applying these facts, creating a relationship with these persons can never be completely or innocent when he knows that he's attending a party, when he's the only NCO, that it's during the odd hours of 10 to 4, that they're underage, that they're drinking, and knowing those certain facts.
So you are saying it's a strict liability offense?
Sorry, Your Honor?
It seems to me you are saying it's a strict liability offense, or what are you saying?
There's no indication that Sec Army intended this to be a strict liability offense. And again, reading the wrongful as well as the actual, the regulation would imply, well, general intent from there. But you're right, Your Honor, there is no express language in 414, or at least this version.
And no language in the instruction. It's not that there's a question of Sec Army trying to turn this into a strict liability offense. There's the word wrongful in there. But the question is, what would that mean to a panel member? What would the word wrongful mean to a panel member if it's not explained to them?
Yes, sir. Again, Your Honor, just wrongful would just be applying it directly to 414 Bravo on the relationship that is formed. But outside of what the instructions were given, that's all that can be from 414 and the instruction itself, the wrongful and the context of the regulation.
Captain Esposo, can't the members rely on their own concepts of military tradition when it has to do with disparity in rank and how they should associate with each other? Can't they rely on how the military has traditionally treated this kind of activity? I mean, if you're a captain, don't most members rely on the fact that you shouldn't be dating a private? I mean, I'm just asking, you know. At some point, doesn't common sense have to enter the equation?
And that does...
I agree, it may not be as common as purported, but but that's my question.
Yes, sir. Common sense and wisdom role definitely apply to fraternization and the elements. And in this case, that is what the panel did when presented with...
Aren't the members generally told they don't have to leave their common sense at the door? Or were they told that in this case?
Yes, sir.
All right.
That's what I think what Judge Sparks may be getting at is, why is this case, given that it's a uniquely military offense, even though it's charged as a general orders violation, why is it more like Caldwell than Haverty?
Well said.
I
could have said just that.
I'm woefully over time, if I may respond, sir.
You may.
Haverty does not have that rank disparity built into the regulation like Codwell does. So where the subordinate and superior relationship is crucial and important to good order and discipline, that same language appears in the Department of Army pamphlet that was issued with the Army regulation stating that importance of the proper boundaries between NCOs and junior enlisted soldiers. So where hazing can, it doesn't matter what the rank is, in the case of fraternization, that is specifically targeted.
May I follow with one? Did the military judge in the instructions, or did the case otherwise, focus on a particular aspect of 414B? That is, the five subparagraphs there, and they're all different. What's this case about, and how did the members know which one is what it was about?
So, sir, that wasn't actually addressed in the bill of particulars, just the members that were affected. In this case, they charged it based on his appearance at the party or his attendance at the party. What was actually litigated was whether or not it created a actual impact on discipline, and tangentially argued the perception of an adverse impact. And we're able to distill from the record that because defense counsel repeatedly stated that they were not in a supervisory chain of command and that they weren't even the same unit. However, the regulation doesn't require that. And insofar as appellant was doing barracks checks in specialist VM's barracks right before the party, they're still in effect on good order and discipline without the supervisory role.
And because we're in a plain error situation on this issue, whose responsibility would it have been to identify which aspect of 414B was at issue in the case? Was it the responsibility of the government or the responsibility of the defense to request a narrowing instruction in that regard?
Well, defense, Your Honor, and they, admittedly, they did file a bill of particulars, but again, the response was just limited to the members that were affected by fraternization, and there was no follow-on regarding what subsection of 414B.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
I'd just like to answer the three questions that I had left from my, introductory portion. So, Judge Olson, I want to go back to the mens rea piece. Over the context of the colloquy with the government counsel, there's only just two final points I want to make. And one, Your Honor, I think you hit on the key with, Sandstrom v. Montana. The Supreme Court has said we look at what a reasonable juror would impute from an instruction, not from what an appellate court might. In this case, I think a reasonable juror could have easily thought this was strict liability.
Why doesn't the fact that trial defense counsel failed to object, failed to offer up additional instructions, prove deadly to the defense here? Why isn't it that, with plain error review, the fact that wrongful was instructed to the jury, defense didn't ask for any explanation of that, Why doesn't that mean it passes muster?
It puts us in plain error, Your Honor, which puts us with a tougher standard. It was satisfied in Haverty, and we would posit that it is satisfied here based on the language and based on how a reasonable juror could interpret it. And it's reviewed for plain error at the time of the appeal. And I think in line with this court's spectrum of cases over this very issue, we would again posit that it meets that admittedly higher standard because of the lack of – it's not preserved. The second point I wanted to make is, I guess, a rebuttal point, which is this offense doesn't have a superior subordinate inculcated either. Specialist Robinson was not the supervisor of anyone at the party, and I think that was well established, that he did not have a supervisory relationship. And I think the ways the world, as it was argued, is, well, he may be someday. And we would say that runs afoul of the baseline principles from Alanis that wrongdoing must be conscious to be criminal, and a guilty mind is a necessary element of every element in the charge sheet and proof of the crime. So in sum, Your Honor, I think looking at the Sandstrom v. Montana and its important effect, the language here, the spectrum of cases, and the lack of superior-subordinate relationship.
Superior-subordinate is only one facet of fraternization. You know, it's like the notion that you can't have fraternization without sexual hanky-panky. Not true. Ultimately, fraternization is the codification of a custom of the service, as Judge Sparks was talking about. And isn't it really associating with subordinates, whether you supervise them or not, on terms of military equality? Which seems like going to a party and consuming copious amounts of alcohol with them might be.
And, Your Honor, my response would be, I think that is the spirit of the spirit.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the letter. And I think the panel could have looked at those five categories, said objectively, without any consideration of his mens rea, without any consideration of his subjective intent, we think this meets one of the five. It doesn't matter what he thinks. It matters what we think, and we think it meets the criteria. Alanis said what Alanis thinks matters, and there's a real danger here that the panel did not think that what Specialist Robinson thought mattered. Lastly, Your Honor, getting back to your questions, I think, as I'm so close to being out of time, I think that the
you may take the time you need to answer Judge Efron's question.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I'll take the second one first, the specificity. We think that's more of a B1B analysis or a B1B consideration as opposed to B1C because of the differing language between the two. I think it is a potential consideration in the context of whether they met their standard, but there is a much more specific nexus associated with B1B vice B1C. And I think your first question, Your Honor, if I understood it correctly, and I'm sorry I may be a little bit afoul, is the necessary balancing in the context of the ruling. And I think that any of the balancing is kind of inculcated by the, 403 analysis embedded within the standard for B1C as outlined by this court. And I know I'm out of time.
Let me try to boil that down.
Yes.
If the court determines that the information offered by the defense met the minimum standard of relevance, is that the end of it?
No.
Thank you. That answers the question.
Any further questions?
Thank you. Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court will recess to assemble again at 10:35.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:35.